session number 10429, reel 3.
Former command was very much concerned that the squadron operated as it did as an effective bomber squadron equipped with Wellington 1Cs like the other squadrons in 3 Group, and at times we were often concerned that the Foreign Office were more concerned with their diplomatic outlook on its propaganda value. We were visited by Dr. Benesch, the exiled president of Czechoslovakia, and young Jan Masaryk, who was much later on to commit suicide in Czechoslovakia under the communist regime. It was a very interesting phase. The Czechs at that time had greatest difficulty in recruiting replacement crews. They had a big drive in Canada, which wasn't very effective, where there were hundreds of thousands of Czechs, apparently. And it came to the stage that just before I left, it became obvious that we were unable to replace crews. And so the squadron was transferred down to Wales to join Coastal Command, where they flew maritime operations very effectively, and fortunately without losses that they couldn't replace. I thought that was an interesting period, because there were no recriminations ever from the Czechs, because though we consciously had, on the face of it, let the Czechs down, as we did subsequently in the Poles once the war started, there were never any recriminations or any hard feelings. They were a very boisterous, musical lot, very friendly, and on the whole good allies. The squadron was kept operations while quite a number of other squadrons at that period were more or less grounded, while they were equipped with this navigational aid called G, which has been so well described. It was a means of getting fixes from lattice charts, taking bearings from beacons in this country, which was effective for a few hundred miles well into Germany. It was a navigational aid rather than an effective bombing aid. It was reasonably accurate and a very effective means of more accurate navigation. This was 1942, early part of 42. I then went off to a staff college course, but funny enough, at my homestead here nearby, Jones Cross, for a war course. And then there was a war course condensed from a pre-war staff course, which a lot of visitors and things were cut out, but they worked us right through the weekend, often at night. I then was posted in, after a conversion course, onto Halifax's. Oh, sorry, I'm missing out. I went from the Staff College, I went to headquarters, number 3 bomber group, which was at Exning, near Newmarket. And yeah, that's group controlled all the Wellington squadrons and in East Anglia, and began to receive the first of the 4 engine Stirlings on its stations to replace the Wellingtons. I was there for 1942 as Wing Commander Operations, where we was involved in primarily on planning each night's operation, based on, of course, the availability of aircraft in each squadron, and detailing targets, bomb loads, whether they were incendiaries or bombs or what have you. We sent out operation orders, which were virtually extracts from the overall operation order received from early in the morning from Burma Command, which detailed the strategy for tactics for each group, either combined as a whole on one target or separated out into other targets. We had no Pathfinder force in those days, but the more experienced crews of each squadron were designated as target illuminators, and they were equipped with, as we all were, but particularly with them, with parachute flares. The object of the exercise, if they could find the target area, was to illuminate them with these big parachute flares. They were enormous things. They were lethal if they were hitting the aircraft. Sometimes, in the early days, they were had silk parachutes, and if you're on the way back, you've got any left, you used to cut the parachute off and use them as an incendiary on an unsuspecting target. And wives got some silk for underwear. But later on, of course, these were all replaced by nylon and other fabrics, cotton. The illuminators were, of course, were only effective if they could light up a target. There was no cloud or anything to obscure them. And if they could find the target. But at that time, there was rumblings about the creation of a Pathfinder, designated Pathfinder force. As one well knows this day, that by that time, Bomber Harris had taken over command of Bomber Command, and the story goes that he didn't want a designated Pathfinder force. Equally, the squadrons didn't want to have their best crews and more experienced crews creamed off to start this force. But anyway, while I was I first went to 3 Group under Air Vice Marshal Jackie Baldwin, who was a well-known character in pre-war days and had retired as the war started, but was came back in again. And his place was taken by, while I was at 3 Group, was by Air Vice Marshal Cochrane for not very long period, because he was posted up to take over 5 Group. Now, at this time, Don Bennett appeared as a group captain, having been promoted from wing commander having escaped, having been shot down in Norway, and he escaped into Sweden, was brought back from there by a clandestine airline, and had been nominated to start a Pathfinder force. As everybody knows, as a professional airman, I won't go into details about him, was a second to none, with more experience that's been written about than anybody then flying. But of course, comparatively junior officer, though he'd been a pre-war short service officer, and funny enough had served in under Bomber House on flying boats at Pembroke Dock, and I think had also been at Felixstowe, and before he, having done his 6 years, he joined the then Imperial Railways, and everybody knows what went on there. Bennett was posted to Witten to get the Pathfinders underway, and of course, being so junior, he rather, I think, only too obvious, seen some of the jealousies of the more senior commanders who regarded him as probably a bit of an upstart. But, as I say, professional airman, second to none. He got cracking there and eventually moved to Huntingdon. Now, there was to form 8 Group. Now, 8 Group was going to be another bomber group at Brampton. I well remember going to look at the place with the AOC to designate famous Joe Fogarty, but he came to Norton. 8 Group was Pathfinders was based at Huntingdon, and the rest of the story, with its squadrons taken out of 3 Group and other groups, went on into history as a very effective marker force, marking of course for the main force, to which, of course, all the other groups subscribed, except 5 Group, because such was the state of play that Air Marshal Cochrane virtually formed his own marker force, headed by incredible character Leonard Cheshire, who did remarkable solo marking flights in fighters into the heart of Germany, and deservedly got a VC amongst other decorations. But the rest of the main force carried on targets at night, with led by the Pathfinder force, which was very effective. We were using coloured markers. There were many dangers, of course, when there was creep back, which meant that the original markers had to be remarked because the bombing force would creep back downwind with all the smoke and what have you, obscure everything. But that's another story. But all in all, I think it would be true to say that the Pathfinder force did very considerably improve the effectiveness of bomber command at night. The other radar aids that came in, which without the sometimes just as effective without the use of Pathfinder force, inasmuch we had as I previously mentioned G, which was a navigational aid, and there were other things which not all aircraft were equipped with, because there was a limited range, about 400 miles oboe, but most main force aircraft were fitted with H2S. This was a downward looking radar which could, as everybody knows, effectively give you a very good map, even through cloud, of roads and rails and rivers and what have you, In other words, that was very much effective bombing aid. Later on, when I was commanding Mildenhall, we had squadrons equipped with a radar device known as GH, which was even more effective as a bombing aid to bombing. But three group, we prosecuted the war as best we could with the available squadrons, with the introduction gradually then, of course, the four-engine aircraft, and first of all the Stirling and Halifax, subsequently later on the Lancaster. After three group, I was posted. I did a refresher course on to fly Halifaxes, Merlin Halifaxes, the earlier Halifax, and then was posted to take over number 138 Special Duty Squadron at Thamesford. Now, this was quite an unusual squadron, inasmuch that its job was to parachute arms and agents to countries in occupied Europe, from Poland down to the Mediterranean. This meant, of course, Poland, Norway, Denmark, Holland, France, Belgium, and Italy, and so on. The squadron had a detached flight at one time at Maison Blanche in North Africa, and another one and also worked variously from Bleeder in North Africa to operate, help out with Yugoslavia and so on. But the squadron's main force was, main effort was devoted, as I say, to looking after the clandestine resistance forces, very effective forces in the occupied countries. The Halifax, Merlin Halifax, was a very effective aeroplane because the squadron had been equipped earlier, before my time, with Lysanders and Whitleys, Whitley twin-engine aircraft. The Lysanders was used for pickups in France only. But by the time I arrived at Thamesford, the 138 squadron was all Halifaxes, four-engine Halifaxes, and there was a sister squadron, 161, which had a mixture of Halifaxes, Lysanders, and Hudstons. My opposite number in Thamesford was then Wing Commander Freddie Pickard, who'd taken over my flight in 9 Squadron years previously, an old friend, and as everybody knows, he was killed leading a mosquito wing on the Amiens prison breakout. But it was our station commander was a legendary figure, Group Captain Mouse Fielden, who was pre-war personal pilot to then Prince of Wales, then captain of the King's Flight, and remained on the household's staff throughout the war, and after the war resumed the job as captain of the King's Flight and then the Queen's Flight, and went on for years after. He was a character, if there was one.
In what way?
Well, I think one of these irrepressible characters who has always got a ready wit, great sense of humour, and above all, never panicked. I mean, I've never known it, but everybody else would be worried on occasion. He did one or two pickups in Hudson's in France, and I well remember one occasion. I think it was deliberate. He left everything too late, and he had to do an engine test before going down from Thamesford to Tangier, which was our sort of jumping-off place. And he did the engine tests on the flight down to Tangmere, and then went off so late that it was perfectly obvious he couldn't get back to Tangmere that night. And so, of course, needless to say, he went off to North Africa, and or Gibraltar. And, of course, coming back from Gibraltar was loaded with... they had to bring up a three-tonner truck to unload the sherry and hoots, other hoots and bananas and what have you. But he, with all these occasions, even with our operations, when weather was bad and things like, he never showed the slightest sign of anxiety or that sort of thing. He was a he'd been adjutant when I was in 600 Squadron. He'd been adjutant of County Middlesex Squadron. No, he hadn't. Sorry, he had been a member of the squadron, but he's the Prince of Wales aeroplane was used Hendon a lot. I hope enough will be written about him, because I well remember going to his memorial service at Savoy Chapel. An air marshal who gave the address reminded us of two stories of Mousefield, and one was that he'd also got the reputation of bypassing commanders in chief and going straight to the air council, and his reason for that was, he said, was to always go to the organ grinder and never the monkey. And another quip was that he was under pressure from the wholesale to thought that the Queen's flight should be manned by well-educated young gentlemen, and his retort to that, I'd far rather get where I wanted to go to with a sergeant pilot and be lost by an old Etonian. I was able to use that subsequently in my post-war organisation to some advantage. But that's a digression. But Mousefield was a good stage commander, and while I was there, I was his deputy, and he went off and took the King round North Africa, and while I was there, the Air Minister, Sir Archibald Sinclair, decided he wanted to come and see our operations, and came down and stayed a couple of nights. Unfortunately, the weather was foul, and we only had one chap. I got back. I knew he'd get in, but the others had to be diverted. But that was just a phase. And of course, before my time, King and Queen and Princesses had visited, obviously, Thameswood. My predecessor had dropped the team who eventually assassinated in 41, I think, was Heydrich, the monster of Czechoslovakia, and from which unfortunately the Germans took terrible retribution. In my time, we did a number of significant operations. The point about all this is the whole station was top secret, and no one outside was supposed to know, even our relations, what we were up to. And it was a very secure station. And, of course, we did not know. We were working primarily for what was known as the Special Operations Executive, which was based in Baker Street in London, which was controlling all clandestine operations in, not only in Europe, in the Middle East and the Far East. And we were not to know what our object of our particular operations were, because after the war, of course, one was able to knit certain things together, not even on the need to know it, except in one case, and that was Wing Commander Corby, an old friend of mine who was in charge of air operations at Baker Street, the SOE headquarters, came down to see me one day to say that the Germans were after an explosive 1,000 times as powerful as anything yet known. And I said to John at the time, we laughed about it many times after the war, I told him he ought to take more water with it. And of course there was no mention of those days of heavy water or the splitting of the atom, and it was one of, if we'd had heard details at that time, we would have been as unbelievers as when people reported they'd seen an aeroplane flying in Newmarket without a, out a propeller, which was of course our first jet aircraft. But the it was took three attempts to get into what was turned out eventually to be called Operation Gunnerside, which was the destruction of the Norsk Hydro in southern Norway, which was producing heavy water. I think heavy water's got another O in it. I think it's H2O2 or something. It is, even to this day, is used, I believe, as a coolant by the Canadian in their nuclear generating stations. But the Germans were after it, and the in this vast generating plant, the Norsk Hydro, they were only able, with a battery of stills, to produce little drip, drip, drips of heavy water. And the weather, of course, you can imagine, the effective drop was in February 1943, when the team of six, who are still alive today, got in, were dropped miles away from the target area. They nearly starved in up in the mountains, got in very effectively and quietly, and overpowered the guards and destroyed the stills. There have been films about it, showing American film saying the way they blasted their way in, had a love interest and all the rest of it. But in fact, the only decent documentary of it is was not added to the recent SOE series by BBC, because they'd already done a good documentary called Altmark, which was shown some years ago. They got in and one of them chased but got back. Some of the state in Norway, some were brought back in the clandestine airline. But the real crux of this whole thing, the Germans panicked, and they took all their drums of, they'd taken many months to build up of heavy water, and put them on a train ferry. And this, by other chaps I've met, was effectively mined and lost on a deep fjord on the way back to Germany. The result of which all this was that Albert Speer and Hitler agrees that they would not continue with their nuclear weapon development. The point really is that the Germans had the know-how virtually, the uranium and so on, and plutonium, and it was, I'm only glad to see, and Bill Casey, the late CIA's head's book, that they were in fact, that this was effectively just stopped.